All right. Welcome, everyone. I think we're finally up and running. I apologize for the delay. This was due to the fact that this room is used for teaching up until 5 o'clock, and so we had to make an adjustment to the microphones and set them up. We couldn't proceed without the microphones because, as you may know, this event is being podcasted and video recorded to ensure that everyone in the world can benefit from our shared discussion about Professor Halak's new book. So my name is Lee Janko. I'm a professor of political theory here at the London School of Economics in the Department of Government. And I'd like to welcome you to this event discussing Professor Wael Halak's book, Restating Orientalism, A Critique of Modern Knowledge. This event is organized by the LSE Department of Government. And the event hashtag, should you wish to Twitter it, is LSE Orientalism. Hashtag in front of that, of course. I'm the chair. I will be introducing our speakers. I will also be moderating Q&A. The idea is for Professor Halak to speak for about 35, 40 minutes, after which our three discussants, Humaira Iqtidar of King's College London, Sanjay Seth of University of London Goldsmiths, and Georgios Varoufakis, whose name I just learned to pronounce, is a professor at Queen Mary University of London, will be speaking for about 10 minutes each. This should leave us approximately 45 minutes for audience participation. There will be microphones. You will need to use the microphone because, as I said, this event is being recorded. So without any further ado, I should probably introduce the man that you've all come to see tonight, the man who needs no introduction, Professor Wael Halak. Thank you.
Thank you, Lee. Thank you, Humaira, for the wonderful invitation. I thank you and thank your institutions that stand behind you. I would like to begin first by outlining the major themes of the book for the benefit of those who have not read it. I will then move on to a discussion of how this book fits into a larger project, a move that will itself be conducive to explaining the deeper structures of the work itself, and of course to tell you a little bit about the next phase in my work. I think the first thing to know about Restating Orientalism is that it is not really about Said's celebrated work. As I repeatedly stress in the book, I dwell mainly in the first chapter on his work because even after 40 years of its publication, it continues to represent the mainstream outlook on the subject and problems it dealt with. In other words, I deal with Said because his work remains standard, but neither the work nor the author stands in any way as my terminus ad quem. The second point I wish to make is that the discourse on Orientalism and its problems is analogous to the discourse on the Holocaust and other genocides, with the crucial difference that this genocide discourse has been developed in promising directions and been given some depth and critical dimensions. Anyone familiar with the writings of critical theory circles, with Hannah Arendt's and Zygmunt Bauman's writings, among others, will know that the Holocaust and all phenomena of the same species are not exceptions to the modern condition, but rather structurally integral to it, embedded in it, and the consequence of it. To study one such genocide is to study a building block in the house of modernity. One of the goals of Restating Orientalism is to embark on a similar exercise with the explicit purpose of showing that Orientalism is not just a field of specialization within academia that has been inflicted with certain epistemological problems. Nor do I think that uncovering traces of Orientalism or racist discourse in European literature does anything to enlighten us about the structures of thought that made Orientalism possible. Of course, here I am referring to Said's other work, Culture and Imperialism. What I propose in this book is that we should look much deeper than what Said has articulated and what the entire post-colonial discourse, that his work has spun over the last 40 years has managed to accomplish. I locate the problems of Orientalism in the deepest structures of Enlightenment thought, and in fact in the epistemological and ethical makeup of modernity as a whole. I locate it, to be blunt, in its effective anti-human and anti-natural proclivities. Sa'id, the liberal and secular humanist, could not, I argue, transcend his own epistemological boundaries in order to subject the very liberal project as an Orientalist one. In brief, and capitalizing on a theory of paradigms that I elaborated in The Impossible State, I argue that all academic disciplines of the central domains, including the range of scientific fields, engineering, business schools, economics, law, psychiatry, philosophy, history, and a host of others, including much of post-colonial studies, in fact, are as fields of discourse and knowledge deeply and structurally implicated in Orientalism. Being themselves Orientalists, they are complicit in colonialism over man and nature. The peripheral domains, such as music and the fine arts, are generally, but not exclusively, exonerated from this venture. But let's leave these on the side for the moment. All of this, I would say, comes to about half of the book's arguments. The other half, spreading over three long chapters, deals with problems and issues that were not on Sa'id's mind, and likewise continue to be largely absent from the discourses that his work generated. One such issue that pervades the entire book is that of sovereignty, which I often tie to conceptions of agency as they have come to inhabit so much of post-colonial discourse. I argue that because of the rise of the 17th and 18th centuries of a new conception of the human, we have consequently come to inhabit a being in the world that is dominated by an unprecedented concept of sovereignty, that is, sovereignty over everything. That is, actually, unlimited sovereignty over everything. While many of us may not dispute this phenomenon, I don't think that we have sufficiently teased out its implications. Foucault, for instance, understands the problem with a penetrating insight, but he never really cared about its destructive colonialist effects on man, all men, and nature. The sovereignty of the secular age, I argue, has not only been implicated in genocide in its widest definition, and has not been responsible only for wiping out of so-called traditional cultures, but also for colonizing the future. Another dimension that I did not explore sufficiently in the book, but can command at least another book if one wants to take it as their pet. By implication, sovereignty in restating Orientalism emerges not only as the real god of gods, but as a bundle of criminal and psychotic world of behavior. To make my case, I take a fairly close look at the corporation, especially the multinational variety, as well as the Schmittian Agambian state of exception, to show that the distance between modern polity and modern economics and materialism, which together make so much of the modern project, on the one hand, and criminality and destruction, on the other, is not really a big one at all. That's one important theme in the book. But there is yet another. I argue that Sa'id was confused about the theory of the author, misunderstanding Foucault, who himself, I think, did not tease out the implications of the very idea of the author that he dabbled with. The book then can be said to begin an inquiry into a typology of the author that identifies a new subset of authors, namely the dissenting and subversive authors. The dissenting and subversive authors. This classification also ties to Kant's and Foucault's concepts of critique, which was not immediately relevant to me in the book, but one that will hopefully follow soon. The point is that the author as critic must be distinguished because it is precisely here that the meaning of critique finds its most fertile grounds. As I argue in the book, and as I hope to develop the argument soon, a critique to meet the Kantian but not the uncertain Foucauldian conditions must come from outside of what I have called central domains. Critique as a theoretical construct is then an important theme in the book. And so chapters 3 and 5 capitalize on these notions in order to sort out the kind of authors who meet and do not meet the qualifications of so-called bad Orientalist and good Orientalist. To do this, I bring in the French Orientalist René Guénon, who emerges as a subversive author, as compared to Saïd himself, who is merely a dissenting author. I say merely because Saïd and the entire discourse his work has generated in Western academia has not met the conditions of critique I mean here. But my use of Guénon has more to it than meets the eye. I attempt to show that one can be an Orientalist and still be a subversive critic, which is to say that even if I were to call for the abolishment of many academic fields of the central domain, such as engineering and business schools, I would not call for the deletion of departments of Orientalism, whether they study China, India, Africa, or Islam, among others. And the reason for this is precisely that it is through Orientalism, among some secondary others, that a subversive critique, actually, can be conducted, as I show Guénon to have mostly done. Finally, in the last chapter of the book, and after having dwelled at length on the rise in modernity of the problem of knowledge and power, I deploy a critique of the modern subject, especially the liberal one, and propose, while engaging the present disciplines of Orientalism and history, that to exit our current modes of knowledge, the subject must be reconstituted. But I must say that the story of this reconstitution is not complete, at least in the meantime, I mean in my own project. I take up this project of reconstitution, the sequel if you wish, in the last part of another book that should appear next year, likely under the title Reforming Modernity. There I dwell again on the concepts of sovereignty, materialism, gratitude, and humility to make my argument for a new concept of the human. Building on the Moroccan moral philosopher Abdulrahman Taha's theorization of the subject, I argue that we can indeed speak of particular qualities that characterize the new concept of the human. These characteristics are to be distinguished from the techniques that are indispensable for forming this human, this subject. I mean techniques as technologies of the self. The characteristics are the minimal essentials that make such a human new, make her who she will need to be. As an antidote to the modern malaise, each of these characteristics are deemed essential because each performs, along with the others, a particular task, the totality of which make up the condition of a sufficient palliative. If essences are involved in this narrative, it is because the malaise dictates and requires them as a matter of necessity. Change the malaise, and the essences will in turn change. Change the malaise, and of course the medicine will have to change. Since the diagnostic, that is critique, undeniably operates within a specific and fairly well-determined etiology, we can then comfortably speak of a set of essential characteristics. I said that these characteristics are not to be confused with techniques, since these latter, that is the technologies of the self, represent the variable method by which a necessary characteristic is achieved. Techniques are contingent necessities, which is to say that they are indispensable and essential as family and genus, but contingent and thus mutable as species. The family of habituating acts and praxis are concomitant with all human groupings. Every society, or socially constituted aggregation of individuals needs and cannot live without some kind of technique, including ours, modernity. Genera, however, make up the spectrum of family membership. As an example in point, two such genera are the modern paradigmatically exemplified in the Althusserian ideological, and what may be called here, for lack of a better term, the traditional Asian. This latter, in turn, is divisible into a number of species, including the Islamic, the Jewish, the Hindu, the Taoist, and the Buddhist, among others. The realm of technique, precisely because they are techniques, is vast, although conceivably exhaustible. My point is that technique as a species is the sphere of ingenuity, capable of creating and recreating modes of habituating practices and technologies of embodiment. My other point is that the modernist forms of habituation, that is, that those that create the subject, ranging from the Althusserian ideological to the Foucauldian disciplinarian, stand as key co-equal genera and not a different species under the same genus. Now, taking for granted that every subject must be located within and formed by one type of technology or the other, one type of habitus or another, a new concept of the human will be said, in light of modernity's specific crisis, to enjoy a number of essential characteristics, all of which are interrelated and constitute a single, single interconnected whole. I will return to this point shortly. But please note, so I wouldn't lose you, that what I am about to say goes right into the heart of what may be cast as how not to be an Orientalist, of the sort, of course, I critique in restating Orientalism. So all of this is not really just about the second project, which is the reconstitution of the new human, so to speak, but it's really, it goes, ties directly into the project of Orientalism. Now, a point of entry to this interconnected whole I'm speaking of is the characteristic of anti-materialism, generally defined as a critical and systematic transgression against divination of the material world, where matter, including the human as materially conceived, has been endowed with the highest value. Materialism is therefore not just a physically disposed attitude to the world, but also, and in fact primarily, a metaphysical conception of material reality as one of brute, inert, and stupid matter, to cite Robert Boyle's famous descriptors. This metaphysics also rests on a potent conception of instrumentalism that systematically makes a habit of confusing ends with means, converting the former into the latter, and rendering the modern telos an unattainable desideratum. The anti-materialists, by contrast, recognize higher principles as ever-binding, precisely because these principles are not subject to the discretion and whim of materialism. This is not to say that material existence should or can be abolished from the world, for the world is, after all, made of matter. But the world is obviously not just matter, nor is it just the total sum of all of its parts. Nor does matter signify, in this conception, the brute and the stupid, again Boyle, the brute and the stupid. Whether at the spiritual metaphysical level or the material physical plane, sentient and insentient life lives in and with matter. Every living organism is matter and requires materiality for survival, yet this is only one of the grounds of existence in an infinitely more complex universe of forces. The anti-materialist therefore recognizes that in this complex existence, materialism is no more than a means to an end. And the two are neither twin, nor are they to be confused. Matter is always subservient, yet still integral, to a higher order of existence that is made of first-order ethical principles. An anti-materialist conception would thus shun capitalism with its modus vivendi and modus operandi, namely the corporation, multinational or otherwise. It would also shun the political structures that are installed to make materialism and capitalism possible and hegemonically operative. If we are to keep in mind that the immediate effects of modernity's malaise, then an anti-materialist critic must uphold, as a matter of principle, a systematic resistance to modern forms of capitalism. For capitalism as a pervasive and dominating attitude, not just as economic form, constitutes virtually the full effect of materialism. An irrational greed, capitalism, like its mother modernity, was ab initio integral to the rise of an instrumentalized materialist outlook on the world, and simultaneously concomitant with the effects generated by the materialist attitude in the world. The new concept of the human must therefore presuppose a subjectivity that is characterized by a categorical absence and total negation in its very constitution of sovereignty. Perhaps the most important theme in both restating Orientalism and reforming modernity. Yet this is not to suggest that sovereignty is substantively separable from materialism, for both go hand in hand. In fact, they are concomitants, since modern materialism presupposes and lives on sovereignty, which is to say that materialism is made ontologically possible by an unbounded form of sovereign epistemology. This is to say that the unbounded materialism of modernity and its subject must be seen as subordinate to sovereignty, for it was this latter that gave rise to what has been called by more than a few an innate love of mastery and control. I am quoting with little bit of variation the language of Max Scheler's here. If all this is anywhere near acceptable, it is not sufficient for a new concept of the human to entertain or settle for the resisting subject, the subversive agent who refuses who we are, what we are, to quote Foucault. To become performative, refusal must embody itself in a normative substrate, a substructure of thought, action, and feeling that systematically and systemically embed resistance and refusal in a habituated psycho-epistemology of humility and modesty, all of which run against the core of Foucault's concept of resistance. Abdurrahman Taha's chosen term for this is humility, is haya in Arabic, which I translate as shyness with the humility. So it's haya is non-translatable, but I take it to really philosophically mean humility, a philosophical term also of variegated and intertwined meanings. I take haya to include, in the most profound of ways, the concept and habituated feeling of gratitude, without which no modesty before or respect of anything is ever possible. Nor is there gratitude without humility, or humility without modesty. If the Foucauldian refusal and resistance are negative approaches, and they certainly are, then humility, modesty, and gratitude are the positive, non-defensive, and self-confident modi vivendi of being in the world, of living in the world. A new concept of the human thus generates a subject who does not recognize sovereignty and who cannot conceive of herself as being sovereign. Here, the Kantian trio of free rational will, by which I mean the specifically Kantian architecture of freedom, rationality, and willing, has no place in the architecture of the new subject, who perceives herself as devoid of the impulse to mastery and the quest for knowledge, for power, sorry. For to be a master of anything, you at least must be a willing and free subject within that relationship. Yet to say, as I have just done, that the new concept, that the new subject conceives herself to be devoid of this very impulse, is to overstate the point and misrepresent it. The new human would be intrinsically incapable of this mode of cognition. For to be able to conceptualize the meaning of sovereignty, mastery or domination, is to already be engaged with them in one way or another. To think them and to know them is to entertain their possibilities and potentialities. For it is true, I shall insist, that cognition is not only consciousness of the possible, but also an inroad to the performative. It is my argument then that resistance and refusal, a characteristic Foucauldian duo that follow on the heel of critique, are insufficient for producing the new concept of the human I am trying to articulate here. What is needed instead is a new habitus, and more precisely, a new form of embodiment and ethical cultivation that permit no place either for the love of mastery and domination or for the very cognition of any forms of sovereignty. A new concept of the human thus demands a new forms of acculturation, education, and upbringing. The forms in this new configuration take it for granted that the subject is formed by humility, modesty, and gratitude, all of which are not mere nouns and derivative descriptors, but effectively performative as technologies of the self. They are not, in yet other words, just qualities that we may preach or admire, but they rather stand as constitutive of a world of value in which the subject is born and nurtured systematically, systemically, and constitutionally. Humility is never timidity or meekness, nor is it submission or servility. It is, like modesty, a world in which pride and vanity have no central room for maneuver. If pride and vanity are human qualities, which they undoubtedly are, then they are to be suppressed and kept at bay, just as we, in the modern condition, abhor dishonesty, cunning, and the like. If modesty is unpretentiousness, moderation, and simplicity, then gratitude is appreciation, thankfulness, and deep feeling of indebtedness. And all of these interconnected qualities make for a new habitus, a performative technology, and an uncompromised way of living in the world, not above it. They are, in other words, not the stuff of theory and words, but rather the stuff of real practice, or rather praxis, which is really a systematic form of practice. Nor is living in the world, the in here is extremely important, not above it, just a virtuous quality that makes for a merely desirable way of experiencing the world. Living in the world, our fourth characteristic, is nothing short of a psychoepistemology dictating how one qualitatively lives and the full meaning of life in the world. A new concept of the human recognizes the world as a unity where all things, sentient and insentient, stand in an interconnected whole. This is an inner formative conception of reality, a view from within, an outlook integral to and internally embedded in a conception of the world as one formed by interconnections and continuity. To say that the world is continuous is to conceive of a fabric of being that makes everything one does, every omission and commission, relevant and thus effectual to everything else. It is also to say that because this living in the world is a psychoepistemology, continuousness and continuity are substantively made of an ethical fiber endowed with an epistemology and ontology of responsibility and accountability. Whatever one does or says, or does not do or say, has an effect on something ad seriatim around it, both conceptually and existentially. And if ethics is the way in which we speak of a genuine concept of responsibility, then everything that is said, done, or altogether omitted is inevitably engulfed and judged by this ethics. Responsibility then cannot be grounded in a rhetoric whose foundations are laid by anthropocentrism or secular humanism, for these have proven incapable of genuine solutions to many of the problems generated precisely because of them. And I think the chapter 5 of the book deals with this at some length, of restating Orientalism. The idea here is that the new human sees itself as standing in a series of equally created beings, all deserving of respect precisely due to the indomitable fact of equal createdness. Yet this equality is distinguishable. The fact that the mare and its foal are equal members of the equidae never entails assigning them the same functions or responsibilities. Just as the mare is under the natural and instinctive duty of caring and attending to its foal, the human is under the primordial obligation of universal stewardship. This is the natural lot and burden of humanity, just because it has been assigned in the nature of things to bear the unique weight of ethics. The only animal in the world that has a problem with ethics is us. This is why Abdul Rahman Taha justifiably refuses the identification of the quiddity of humanity as a merely rational species, unlike the Aristotelian tradition, all of it. For modern rationality, as a denuded and narrow form of reason, has proven capable of turning things into their opposites. It is, after all, modern rationality that has justified and performed genocide, cultural and communal destruction, environmental destruction, and innumerable forms of calamity. You have a very nice long list in Restating Orientalism. Maybe you should read it twice when you reach that part. The concept of continuity and continuousness in the world thus demands bearing the burden of ethical responsibility of stewardship. But unlike Hans Jonas and his likes, despite their admirable work, who seem incapable of comprehending the depth of the status of equal createdness, we must not allow for this massively interconnective link to be missed. Humility and gratitude are not just states of consciousness. They are so crucial precisely because the human species is both burdened and privileged by the duty of trusteeship and stewardship, both of which translate into care of the world. To be a steward is to live in a world that is psycho-epistemically saturated with the humility and gratitude. It is to live in a world that does not know, much less recognize, mastery and love of domination, and in one word, sovereignty. This absence is in fact a productive presence, for there is no empty space or gap left by the unknowability of mastery. The space is rather an already full mental landscape that understands the necessity and implications of what it means to be a created thing. The very appreciation of the meaning of createdness, of man's contingency, ephemerality, fragility, death, and ultimate insignificance is precisely the necessary thick link that Jonas and others have overlooked. But as creatures of the secularized habit, they have also missed the significance of praxis and psychoepistemology in ethical habituation, a lack that is also striking strikingly absent from Foucault, Judith Butler, and others. Jonas's concept of fear, that is, we should be good stewards of the earth because we should fear the consequences, can never on its own accomplish much. It is for the most part unproductive. When the subject engages a praxis of ethical formation, she effectively engages a set of signifiers that bring together the communal and divine good as a unified world of the reference. It is to understand the full meaning of the summum bonum, which is to say that the good is not a constrained notion of human welfare, but one that brings the individual, the community, and cosmology into one interconnected whole. I think it should be clear by now that the link between Orientalism and the crisis of modern knowledge are not just about how we represent or misrepresent others, how not to be a racist, arrogant, or domineering. This is a relatively superficial stuff. This is actually the argument of the book. And that's not the most important thing that we should be thinking about. When we deal with Orientalism, we would be terribly amiss if we do not approach it as the distillation of the foundational crisis of modern knowledge, crisis that call upon us to reassess the modern subject as the ultimate locus, the seat of this knowledge. To study Orientalism is to study these crises as they inhabit virtually the entire range of academia. To study Orientalism, therefore, must ultimately drive us to try to find alternative to who we are. It is in these alternative that it is in these alternatives that rest on praxis that we can resist. It is with these alternatives that a new system will emerge. Liberation does not come from a state or some political system. Liberation comes from the inside. Thank you.
Thank you. That was excellent. And indeed, it kept to time very well. So we have plenty of time for our discussants and should have plenty of time for Q&A. Right now, I'd like to introduce first Sanjay Seth. You're going first, right? Yeah. This is in our well-crafted plan for how the order of the discussants. Sanjay is from Department of Politics and International Relations at Goldsmiths, University of London. Sanjay.
Thanks. Hi, everyone. When I'm responding seriously to any sort of book, the first thing I have to do is kind of reconstruct the argument in my own head. So in the first part of my very brief presentation, I'm just going to put forth that reconstruction, my encapsulation of what I take the book to be about, then a few brief comments about it, and finally I'll end with a question to Wael. Wael is erudite, interesting, and important book is both about, and yet emphatically not about, Said's influential text, Orientalism. The core argument, as I take it, is in two parts. First, Orientalism as a text is full of inconsistencies, ambiguities, and failings, and at least some of the debate it has provoked, and possibly much of it, is unproductive. Secondly, more importantly by far, Said does not get to the heart of the matter, which is that the discourse of Orientalism is not a departure from or a corruption of the humanism and the Enlightenment sensibility that was Said's and that permeates and informs all his work, including Orientalism, but was rather an exemplar and local instantiation of it. Orientalism, the discourse of Orientalism, in other words, represents and encapsulates modernity and Enlightenment, rather than being a departure or failing or a falling short from it. And in failing to recognise this, in singling out Orientalism for indictment, Said let the rest of the disciplines pass unscathed. That last bit is a quote from Wael's book. If you put the two of these themes together, you get the relation between the title and the subtitle. Orientalism restated, that is, Orientalism more fully stated and with its implications properly followed through in a way that Said did not and could not do, should lead to the much bigger project of a critique of modern knowledge. I agree with both of these core arguments, and will briefly say something about each of them before going on to ask some questions about the relation of the two arguments with each other and hence about the architecture of the book. But just before getting to this, a prefatory remark. A project such as Wael's needs to address the widespread current argument that modernity is in any case a product of the East and the West, of all cultures, that it was a global event, even if unequally so, and that in treating it as European, we acquiesce in the dominant narrative and do a disservice to the agency and the presence of the colonised in the making of modernity. The argument has been made by some historians and many historical sociologists. There's a call for connected histories, and so for one of the important such books, important and interesting such books, Gurminder Bhamra's Rethinking Modernity, in disagreeing with Chakrabarty, writes that while we need to engage with European intellectual traditions, we need to do so by recognising, and I quote, the concepts and traditions are not European. What is at issue is the claiming of these concepts and traditions as European. In other words, we wrongly give Europe the credit for modern knowledge. In his Freedom Time, Gary Wilder, also engaging with Chakrabarty and disagreeing with him, similarly writes that, quote, if modernity is a global process, its concepts are a common legacy that already belong to all of humanity, unquote. I think Vail is right to reject these arguments, or at least the conclusions to which they might lead. Historical sociologists and others have done us a great service in showing that the first the West, then the rest account of the emergence of modernity is unsustainable. That, for instance, the discovery of the New World and 18th and 19th century colonialism were central to the making of the modern, rather than being mere episodes or footnotes to it. And thus, that modernity was a global process. What does not follow, in my view and clearly in Vail's, is that we are somehow co-authors of modernity and that the categories through which it has been represented and constituted are therefore the collective property of humankind. This argument, even though it's animated by political and ethical concerns which are not dissimilar to my own, makes the claims that it does at the cost of overlooking the enormous differences between non-Western traditions and those that originated with Western modernity. It forgets that what is at issue is not assigning credit, not showing that we too contributed to the making of the modern. It's an open question as to whether there's any credit to be distributed in having made the modern in the first place, but rather in mounting a critique of this tradition and of its effects. Let me turn now to Vail's core arguments, two core arguments. Vail offers a series of damning criticisms of Said's Orientalism, ranging from, and the list is far from being exhaustive, the extraordinary lack of historical specificity in Orientalism, the text. Orientalism is at times traced back all the way to the Greeks, and thus the West gets reified into a sort of trans-historical entity more than 2,000 years old, and yet Orientalism is also declared, this time correctly in my view, to be intimately connected to colonialism, in which case its historical time span is very much shorter. His selective and inconsistent borrowings from Foucault, seeking to stir into a rather austere Foucauldian perspective, the most un-Foucauldian notion of the author and humanist assertions of authorial agency, an argument that was made with devastating effect by Jim Clifford not long after Orientalism was published, the confusion between asserting that Orientalism tells us more about the Occident than the Orient, in which case the enormous power of Orientalist discourse in ruling and shaping the Orient disappear from view, and yet at the same time the assertion that Orientalism was central to ruling the Orient, and the occasional claim that Orientals may be better placed to accurately represent the Orient, and the consequent danger of the whole enterprise degenerating into epithets, a way of kind of measuring goodness and badness. And those of us who teach Orientalism, as I do, know that's often how our students end up interpreting it and using it. It becomes a kind of shorthand form for, you know, a sort of identity politics. But this litany of Orientalism's failings is not Vail's main point, but rather simply a prelude to it. These shortcomings are, in his view, for the most part, a consequence of a much deeper failure, namely a failure to recognise that Orientalism, like anthropology, like historiography, like all the other forms of modern knowledge, it is a form of modern knowledge, and that its failings as a form of knowledge and its violence as a form of knowledge power are but a manifestation of what is distinctive about this knowledge. And what's distinctive about modern knowledge is not that it represents the other in unflattering terms, because that is something to be found in most traditions. Rather, what marks modern knowledge out from all these other knowledges that preceded it, and those mostly non-secular ones that have not been swept away or wholly colonised by it, is something else. Orientalism, in Vail's way of unpacking things, is but one instance, his language for it is a peripheral domain, of a more comprehensive paradigm that structures modern knowledge, and what is required is not a critique of Orientalism, but an anatomization of this knowledge, an identification of what made it and makes it distinctive from all other forms of knowledge, and then a critique of it. I won't go into Wade's analysis of what's distinctive about this knowledge. He's told us something about it. It would require summarising the book. The best antidote to that is to read the book if you haven't already done so. But what I will say is that I'm deeply sympathetic, not least because a book I've been engaged in writing for a number of years now, now nearing completion, is engaged in a very similar project. In fact, it's tentatively titled Beyond Reason, Postcolonial Theory and the Social Sciences. My way of proceeding, just in passing, is to argue that there are certain core presuppositions that characterise modern knowledge, chiefly that knowledge consists of a subject cognising, usually by representing an object, something which is in some ways akin to your arguments about sovereignty, that explanation must be secular, the knowledge producer is allowed to believe in ghosts and gods and whatever else he or she likes, but the knowledge produced can never invoke them, and that nature is devoid of purpose and meaning, while the human and the social are the domain of meaning and purpose. And this is what authorises the first and most fundamental distinction and part much of the architecture of modern knowledge, the distinction between the natural and the social sciences. So nature is disenchanted, so to ask what it means is simply to ask the wrong question, even though for much of human history that is one of the questions that was posed of nature and human thought. These presumptions were once novel and had to be argued and fought for, but they hardened into axioms and became naturalised and presented themselves not as a way of understanding and being in the world, but as the right way of doing so. This was aided or even enabled by the fact that what distinguished the Enlightenment was not that it was a tradition that produced a knowledge claiming to be superior to all others. Again, other traditions do that too, but that it did not see itself as a tradition at all. What was distinctive about the Enlightenment was that Enlightenment knowledge claimed not only to be true, but declared itself to be deduced from nothing less than reason itself, rather than being grounded in the ideals and practices of real historical communities. And that's why Kant lies at the apex of the Enlightenment. That is the most thorough attempt to, as it were, the Munchausen effect, to grab yourself by the hair and pull yourself up, to produce, to show that the very categories of reason can give you universal truths, and that those are universal irrespective of where you are and who you are, whether you're Chinese, Indian, whatever it might be. And of course, this was a source of great self-confidence. It was also an immense historical achievement in many ways. But it was always a limited one. It wasn't the discovery of a truth. It was the discovery and the creation of a way of being in, cognizing and inhabiting the world. It was also a source of great self-confidence and of enormous arrogance and condescension. And of course, that intellectual moment coincided, more than coincidentally, with the historical moment when Europe, and only Europe, had the means to impose its will upon the world. I'll end with a question to Wai'u. When I sort of imagined what this might look like, I sort of imagined a conversation, and possibly I misimagined it, but there might be a chance for a response. The question's a fairly simple one. Given that you move from a withering critique of Orientalism to the bigger question of modern knowledge, which is at the heart of your book, my question is, why restate Orientalism at all? In other words, why is Orientalism and Said your route into this? And it's telling that for you, as for me, some of your important intellectual reference in the book, the people who help you think what you want to do, are figures like Foucault, self-evidently, but McIntyre, Talal Assad, Bruno Latour, but not Said. Said, in fact, in some ways, is almost like an impediment to thinking this project. In which case, my question is simply, why the engagement with Oriental? And the answer might simply be, and it's a perfectly good answer, that it's, in a sense, serendipitous, reasons to do with personal trajectory and so on. Those sorts of reasons often loom large, and we kind of censor them in the academy because we like to pretend that the architectonic was there from the beginning. And we never sort of had rough drafts in which we scribbled things out and, you know, we spilt the coffee cup on it and that changed the architecture and so on. But maybe I'm just riffing on myself, but yeah, serendipity has played a very large role in my intellectual formation. So was it just serendipity, or is it your understanding or claim that for some reason, Orientalism is a privileged point of entry into a critique of modern knowledge? In other words, does it offer us some special point of leverage? Is there some reason why it's either necessary or, if not necessary, particularly advantageous to proceed via this route? And I think I'll end there.
Thank you, Sanjay. Next, we have Humera Iktidar, who is senior lecturer in politics, in the Department of Political Economy, excuse me. It is a multidisciplinary department at King's College London.
Thank you. So Lee tells me I have less time than the others.
Just not as important.
I know, I realize that. So I'll try and shoot through what I have to say. I mean, we all know that Professor Halaq is not known for treading softly. And after The Impossible State, restating Orientalism is in a sense taking the arguments from The Impossible State to another level. And it's another critical intervention that presents a stark and provocative argument. And I think the purpose of that is for us to act to denaturalize and denormalize various categories that we use to think about life and think about academia. I want to focus today, in the brief time that I have, on the question of sovereignty. And so Weil has spoken about it, and as has Sanjay. Sovereignty is a very important and almost foundational idea in contemporary political theory and also in democratic practice, right? The sovereign is he or she or that which has the ultimate authority to make laws, to enforce laws within a territory. It's the ultimate lawmaking and law-giving authority. The notion of popular sovereignty, the fact that people have this ultimate, people as a collective have this ultimate right to make laws and to define what is legal, that is central to the legitimacy of democracy as a system of governance. And the idea of the sovereignty of the self, that each one of us has sovereignty over ourselves and in our beings, all three of these ideas are connected and have been naturalized. And what Weil does in this book is to actually really open up the idea of sovereignty to much more critical thinking and goes beyond what he did in The Impossible State. Now, there is, of course, a very complicated history to how the concept became naturalized, to how the idea of sovereignty was naturalized, particularly within the European context, and how and why it became a foundational concept. Why it started residing in the state and not, say, with the monarch or divine laws or even with the parliament, how the notion of popular sovereignty and state sovereignty became intertwined so that when we think about state sovereignty, we're also thinking at the same time about popular sovereignty. And so I don't want to go into that complicated history. I just want to actually gesture towards the fact that, as Weil points out, that this complicated history of the emergence of sovereignty within the European context is linked to many other important and historically, in some ways, contingent developments as well, right? So Baudin, the first kind of systematic theorist of sovereignty, it is not a coincidence that he starts thinking about this at a time of the Reformation, at a time of bloody wars, and at a time when he's actually not thinking about popular sovereignty. So how the idea of state sovereignty or sovereignty of the prince gets translated into individual sovereignty and political sovereignty and popular sovereignty is a long and complicated history that today is erased from our view. And what we are left with is this notion that this is a foundational way of thinking about the human being and human life And Weil makes, he wants to move the conversation into an entirely new direction. Rather than thinking through this historical context in any more detail, and it has been done a lot by intellectual historians, by political theorists, he wants us to think about the implications of sovereignty. What happens when sovereignty, when notions of sovereignty, when these multiple notions of sovereignty become intertwined and naturalized, when we think this is the only way to be? He builds on Foucault's analysis, but he moves beyond it, and he wants us to think about why the modern state that first took shape in Europe moved beyond domination to sovereignty. Right? So domination, he suggests, is what pre-modern empires and states had routinely practiced. But sovereignty was new and went much beyond domination. So I'm going to quote him here. He says, "The term domination does not articulate the meaning of unbounded will to control and influence something or someone else, nor does it exclude external restraints or higher moral or ethical considerations that define the play, the field of play and its range. Domination can still obtain when ruling a subject population while being restrained by physical and even moral principles. Islamic empires and kingdoms are a case in point. They dominated the subject populations, but under the constraint of a law that were not that, of a law that was not of their own making and that constrained them in multiple ways. Sovereignty, however, does not only rule over principles, but makes them as it goes along as well. Sovereignty is, he argues, heavily defined and imbricated by the is-ought distinction, such that what the subject or the state does becomes legal, even if it ought not to be. His suggestion, therefore, is that pre-modern empires dominated, and they may have killed and they may have destroyed as well, but moral repugnance towards systematic and long-running genocide, environmental degradation, and control of individuals was limited because it was framed, because moral repugnance towards them framed their actions and limited them. So it is the severance of a moral framework from through sovereignty and the severance of a moral framework from contemporary knowledge production and consumption that is then his primary concern in this book. And his effort is to demonstrate that these are all connected. And in this context, he asks us to reconsider the relationship between knowledge and power as it is generally constructed following Foucault. Instead, he argues that in the 17th and 18th centuries, a new form of knowledge was produced that was particularly amenable to being manipulated by power, right? So it's not a coincidence that knowledge and power come into this relationship. It's actually a new form of knowledge is produced that is actually, it's easier to manipulate, and that the coming into being of that knowledge is what we are considering today. Once knowledge was freed from moral concerns, it was available to the state to embark on the colossal 19th century projects, and I'm quoting here, of forming its subjects as citizens. And this by means of creating a number of engineering institutions, which included juridicality, the modern education apparatus, etc. And these were the means through which a new human subject, the object of modern forms of power, was constrained. Now, here again, Islamic history provides a contrast for his purposes. The distance of the scholars and Sharia from the state, the importance of the wider ethical framework within which knowledge was produced, to be produced and consumed, the deep connection between ethics and laws and ethics and education, destabilize the predominantly positive normative associations that we have with sovereignty and with this is-ought distinction it is baked into sovereignty. Said's influential work, Orientalism, Halak argues, does not go far enough in working through the implications of sovereignty for knowledge production and remains too sharply limited in its focus. And Sanjay has already provided a very useful overview of these arguments. There are many risks in the strategy that Weil has decided to pursue. So his strategy is to bring his deep expertise in medieval Islamic law and history and combine it with a wide-ranging reading of contemporary theoretical and philosophical literature, and to articulate to articulate a kind of a positive response to contemporary theoretical, philosophical, and political dilemmas. Now, this stepping out of and beyond the boundaries already. Okay.
That's fine. Actually, I'm giving you a little bit of extra time.
Okay. Thank you. This stepping out of and beyond the boundaries of academic disciplines and their norms means that one opens oneself up to criticism from pretty much everybody, right? Everybody is unhappy to some extent. And in the case of Islamic studies, Weil has gone against the grain by focusing on the difference rather than the similarities between liberalism and Islam. And that, for some time, had become the kind of the norm within Islamic studies. Scholars were looking to see how Islam and liberalism could be made compatible. And Weil has actually gone the other way and said, okay, what are the differences and how are they useful and productive for us to think about alternatives? So this contribution then to contemporary theoretical and philosophical debates, he's used Islamic history and lived experience as a contrast to excellent effect. His argument is not, at least as I understand it, that Islam is the solution to all problems, but that Islamic historical and philosophical experience plays two important roles. One, that it highlights the contingency and parochialism of European experience and thus its political theory. In this book, for instance, it allows him to ask the question, why did European political theory and practice congeal around the notion of sovereignty in the particular way that it did? And why were certain extreme, to take certain extreme but important examples, the machine gun, Holocaust gas chambers, systematic legalization of the genocide of Amerindians, etc., invented in Europe, right? So all of the things that are presented to us as technologies or new laws, etc. Why, if we turn the tables around and start thinking about the problems with them, then we also have to think about why were they invented in this part of the world and not in others? What allowed this close relationship between this kind of knowledge and power? The other important thing that his work does is that it provides a glimpse into alternatives. Now, this is not to say that the Islamic past can be imported wholesale into today's world, but what he's trying to do, and I think this is where it becomes quite useful for us, is that that he's bringing in ideas and utopias from an alternative epistemologies and ontologies for us to think through different horizons. And so there can be no return to a pristine past because there is no pristine past, but the pristine past is not the point of the argument here. The whole point of the argument here, I think, is to think about the future. So I had some questions more about, you know, the relationship between the Islamic tradition and other traditions of thought, because sometimes it seems in the book that you are taking the Islamic tradition as an exemplar of other pre-modern traditions of thought and practice as well. But of course, there are important differences to think about as well. So what exactly is, to your mind, the relationship between the Islamic tradition and other traditions of thought, whether we think about the Chinese or, you know, various other South American traditions? How is it a geographical? Is it a religious comparison? Because in the book, you move across quite a lot in kind of bringing in ideas from these other contexts as well. So thank you very much. I think that that's all I should say.
Thank you, Humaira. Next we have Georgios Veroxakis, who will also be given the same amount of time as everyone.
Yes, sir.
10 minutes, yes, and I'll warn you.
You shouldn't take it personally. Thank you very much to everybody, especially the organizers, who, for making the mistake of inviting me here to speak about something I know nothing about. But luckily, I have only 10 minutes, so there's no time to suffer too much. Who am I to comment on somebody on whose book Sharia my colleague Yossi Rapoport, who is a specialist in the history of Islamic law, wrote that this is the most important monograph in the field of Islamic studies over the last 50 years. And then he told me that the other book is the best book ever, something like that. So I am in great embarrassment here. Obviously, I enjoyed reading the book and learned an awful lot of it. It's not an easy book. It's a book that puts not only Said, but also Foucault and many other people in their place. I immensely enjoyed the theory of the author statement and explanation in chapter 3, and the whole discussion of René Guénon, who I found a fascinating thinker. I had heard about him and thought I should read him, but I had not read him before. Now, to impress our author, I have his book there in my bag. I have many comments which I will not have time to make, so I will have some questions which I hope we might get the chance to discuss both with the audience and with Vail in the discussion. Thankfully, many of my points have been made by my predecessors also. So I will read something, and then I'll tell you why I'm reading it. And it's just in the interests of being the devil's advocate on a very small point. There is a room in the world, no doubt, and even in all countries, for a great increasing population, supporting the arts of life to go on improving and capital to increase. But even if innocuous, I confess I see very little reason for desiring it. A population may be too crowded, though all be amply supplied with food and raiment. It is not good for man to be kept perforce at all times in the presence of his species. We all agree on that. A world from which solitude is extirpated is a very poor ideal. Solitude, in the sense of being often alone, is essential to any depth of meditation and of character. And solitude, in the presence of natural beauty and grandeur, is the cradle of thoughts and aspirations which are not only good for the individual, but which society could ill do without. Nor is there much satisfaction in contemplating the world with nothing left to the spontaneous activity of nature. With every rood of land brought into cultivation, which is capable of growing food for human beings, every flowery waste of natural pasture plowed up, all quadrupeds or birds which are not domesticated for man's use exterminated as his rivals for food, every hedgerow of or superfluous tree rooted out, and scarcely a place left where a wild shrub or flower could grow without being eradicated as a weed in the name of improved agriculture. If the earth must lose that great portion of its pleasantness, which it owes to things that the unlimited increase of wealth and population would extirpate from it, for the mere purpose of enabling it to support a larger, but not a better or happier population, I sincerely hope for the sake of posterity that they will be content to be stationary long before necessity compels them to it. It is scarcely necessary to remark that a stationary condition of capital and population implies no stationary state of human improvement. There would be as much scope as ever for all kinds of mental culture and moral and social progress, as much room for improving the art of living, and much more likelihood of its being improved when minds cease to be engrossed by the art of getting on. Now, this is from John Stuart Mill, an author that doesn't fare very well in the book. He's mentioned incidentally, but it comes from somebody that probably Vail would put at the heart of what he calls the project of modernity and at the heart of what he calls liberalism. Now, Mill wrote all sorts of things that will surprise people, but this is not in a newspaper writing when he was young. It's in The Principles of Political Economy, the quintessential book that should be seen as his major statement of his philosophy, along with his logic. I don't think it proves anything. It's not a criticism. It's more a question. Would Vail consider this an exception, an aberration? Is he a dissenter in this particular issue but not others? What I'm just trying to say is this is an aberration from the anthropocentrism that you would expect from somebody like Mill. I have another question, more important. This was just incidental. As I said, I was very, very impressed by the Guénon chapter 3. So Guénon, for those who haven't read the book yet, was a Catholic thinker who later became converted to Islam, as far as I understand, and went to live in Cairo. Extremely interesting. Became a Sufi. You celebrate his the revival of interest in him, and I was glad to read about that, although it has to be said from various quarters that you wouldn't identify with necessarily. I have noticed that Stephen Bannon and people like that celebrate his views as well. But an author is not responsible for who takes pieces of their works and quotes them, obviously. We would all be in trouble if that was the case. Now, because you very much stress his attacks on what he calls, and you stress the term very very beautifully, the Western outlook, that it's the Western outlook. I don't hate the West, he says. I hate the Western outlook, the way of looking at the world that has been generated in the modern West, prevailed, and then is imposed on the rest of the world. I'll come back to why the Western outlook is important. Because I noticed in the book, I don't remember if you stress it, probably you do, but in the book, L'Orient et l'Occident, 1924, something, 24, I think, first edition, Guénon castigated modern Westerners' disdain for the Middle Ages of Europe. And I could go on and on and on. Guénon reminded me, he has written another book, L'autorité spirituelle et le pouvoir temporel, the spiritual authority and the secular power. All these things reminded me immensely of somebody Guénon criticizes in the books for various particular points, but whose outlook clearly he has adopted to a great extent, and that's Auguste Comte. Now, you'll see why Auguste Comte interests me here. This was a man, I could speak about him for much more than our chair would like, but don't worry, I will not. I've been chairing a lot in recent weeks, and I know the feeling. I will just raise the issue for hopefully further discussion, both today and somewhere else. Comte is a very peculiar case, because Guénon, in the book L'Orient et l'Occident, insists the West has to become a normal civilization. I don't have anything against it as a place. I have a problem with its outlook. The modern West should become a normal civilization like the others. If it becomes a normal civilization, it will not be a danger to others. And clearly, I think you analyze that. He doesn't mean that other civilizations have invaded each other and conquered. He means imposing your outlook on others and erasing everything else and wanting them to think like you. That's what he's worried about. And that's what he calls the danger. So if the West saw itself as a civilization like others, it could live with them, and they could live with it. The problem is that it thinks it's the only one. It's the only civilization, doesn't recognize civilizations in the plural. So the other man I'm talking about, Comte, who was very popular at the time he was writing, in the early 20th century, and everybody had to, not very popular necessarily, but everybody knew him, and everybody had to reckon with Comte. You couldn't ignore him. He was an enormous presence. And he's interesting from your perspective for another reason. The reason we don't talk about him now is that because this was an extremely important thinker in terms of inventing, more or less, the history and philosophy of science, and classifying the sciences, and coming up with a philosophy of history that many people took very seriously, including Mill, by the way, who later took his distances when he realized, no, I can't go there with the rest. Because in his second major work, he proposed his political project, and the political project included the creation of the religion of humanity, proposed that the slogan, vivre pour autrui, you have to live for others. So when I read Scheller, you commending Scheller for saying the heart above knowing or willing, Comte, in his second phase, what is called his second phase, as of the mid-1840s, insisted that the heart and the feelings has to take priority, and morality has to take priority over reason, and so on. Thankfully for you, I have no time to go into his political project. It's very complicated. But what interests me here, and that's why I'm asking, is, well, one thing is, incidentally, therefore everybody treats him as mad, and probably he was a bit mad, but the project was not the result of madness, because the project was there in the 1820s when everybody was taking him very seriously. Yeah. So this is gist to your mill, in a way, that there is a certain rationality, and if you aberrate, even if you are Auguste Comte and you are central to it, suddenly the only way to deal with you, oh, he was mad. He became mad, which, as I said, he was a bit, but that's another matter. The mad project was already there when people took him seriously, except when they realized what he really meant, because a religion was involved, a religion without God, of course. So I'm not saying he was the same as Guénon. I'm saying there is a very interesting, there are many interesting parallels. My question to you is, Guénon was proposing the West should become one civilization like others and stop having universalist pretensions, and then we can all live together. Kant was proposing something else. That he was recognizing that the West is a civilization like others, and he wanted it to reorganize itself in a completely new basis, abolish individualism, abolish nonsense like rights and democracy and parliaments, and organize itself along the lines of a spiritual power headed by the intellectuals, headed by himself initially, controlling morals and education and so on, and keeping the political powers in check, and the political authorities would just run the industry and the affairs of small states that couldn't harm anybody anyway. The plan was utopian, deeply immersed in the idea of peace, a war is an anachronism according to Kant's philosophy of history, and abolition of empires. He was acharnement against empires, and his British followers were the most critical group against the British Empire in Britain for many decades until the Second World War. So, but Kant went further. He said it is the elite of humanity because it's the most advanced, so to that extent he was very much what should be your target, in the sense it is the elite and it has to lead the rest, but in his religion he included Muhammad, he included Confucius, he wanted it to abolish itself eventually, and the capital would move from Paris to Constantinople, Istanbul eventually, when the West would dissolve itself into humanity. I'm not recommending it. It's a mad project in the sense it's extremely Eurocentric, Francocentric, Paris-centric, Kant-centric. and it is of course, an extremely benign plan, provided you accept it's on his terms and on European terms. So everybody else is welcome without force, without violence, without conquest. That's no. Only through sympathy, example, when you want, you can join, when you're ready, and so on. I'm not recommending it at all. I'm saying it's interesting, and I would like to see if you think he's subversive, or if he's dissenting, or he's just mad. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Very quickly, before we move into questions, I'm sure you're all chomping at the bit to ask our distinguished panelists some of those questions. Let me just point out that this event was co-organized by the London Comparative Political Theory Research Group. We meet usually twice a term for events such as these, often for smaller workshops where we discuss work in progress by our core sort of membership. If you'd be interested in receiving our announcements for future events, you can subscribe via the instructions on the screen. Yes, I was going to suggest that you take a picture of it if you're really interested, because otherwise it's just too much to write down. At this point, let me welcome questions. I will reserve the right to take two or three at a time if we have lots of interest. Otherwise, I will just call on you as I roughly see you. Yeah, and Professor Hlock, perhaps you can take center stage so that we can... You can also stand here at the podium if you like. I can be a roving...
It's all right.
Whichever you prefer.
Anyone want to be first? Oh, thank you. Is that me? Yes. Thanks very much. That's really wonderful, and it's very nice to hear about and to see the new work in print. Looking forward to reading it. I just wanted to, it's a clarificatory question. So you say that you both build upon yet depart from Foucault in this, and if you could just again elaborate on how you see your position or the intellectual ground that you are seeking to carve out here as distinct from the Foucauldian critique author, subject, etc. So that was the first question. And the second, I think, very interesting aspect of your critique is that you don't think that we need to jettison modernity as far as I understood, and I just want to clarify, if you think we can work through it, that critique can, in a sense, work through it. And yet, in other parts of your presentation, you say that, well, if you work through it, you're complicit and hegemonized by it. So there seemed to me to be some ambiguity in that position. And if you could help clarify that, I think that would be useful. Okay, I don't want to take more time. I'm Rochna Bajpai. I teach at SOAS and I'm part of the London Comparative Political Thought Organizing.
Okay, do I need to say who I am first? Okay. Okay, so I'm Mustafa Ali. I'm a lecturer at the Open University in the School of Computing and Communications. This is directed to Professor Halaq. When you were framing your concept of matter, you made reference specifically to the thought of Boyle. And I'm just wondering to what extent your critique of materialism takes into consideration more recent work on so-called new materialism and or materialisms. I'm thinking here of people like, the obvious one is Gilles Deleuze, but other names that spring to mind include people like Jane Bennett, Isabella Stengers, Carrie Wolfe, Donna Haraway, and that whole kind of vibrant matter movement. The second part was the extent to which, when I hear your call to engage with the thought of Taha Abdul Rahman, and the way you framed your entire critique of the problem of modernity and its entanglement with Orientalism, to some extent, I was interested how this could be reframed in terms of almost restating Heidegger, in particular his seminal, I guess, later work, The Question Concerning Technology, which could be read it's in parallel with the way you frame your argument. So if you could possibly comment on those two at some point. Thank you.
What was the how would you state the question as a question?
Okay. Do you see an... Okay, so the latter one first, quickly. Is there an isomorphism between the argument made by Heidegger in his later period regarding the encroachment of technology as a worldview and the argument you're putting forth? And regarding the first question, are you cognizant of, and why do you frame matter in the way you do, given the new materialisms?
More questions? Or?
No, I think...
Well, actually, Foucault is probably, I've been increasingly realizing, is probably the most productive thinker that I have ever come across, as far as I'm concerned. I use, as you can see in the last two books, Impossible State, and I use many people and etc. But Foucault has proven, in my work, for me to be, in terms of a diagnostician, as probably the best mind ever. So, as a diagnostician, I do not claim to go disagree or go beyond him anywhere insofar as Europe is concerned. And his work is really largely about Europe. I would put it dramatically and say he, considering what he did in Europe, he failed miserably anywhere outside of Europe. That's well known. But Foucault, the etiologist, is where I begin to disagree with. Foucault remains, despite everything he said, remains to me incapable of escaping liberalism. He questioned everything, but at the end of the day, his mind is still framed with ideas of liberty, which are at the center of the modern project and which need to be reworked, rethought, if not re-engineered. So I would say that his concept of critique is where and therefore, of course, his concept of critique, his concept of even tradition, his concept of ethics, are all need more work. And what I'm suggesting is that if we want to go to fill that gap he leaves in terms of what do we do after we critically begin to resist. He speaks about resistance, but what does that mean in his work? To me, it's an empty void. There is no substance in his work.
In a sense, Foucault did enough himself.
That's right.
That's the project.
He was too busy with diagnostics. I have been busy. Before I die, I want to get myself busy with etiology. It's not enough to be just a diagnostician. We need to begin to do something. And I cannot do anything other than writing books. This is Foucault. Do we jettison modernity or work through it? There is a tension. Probably there is a tension in my work, but I don't think that the tension will last too long. Because jettisoning really means, in a sense, revolution. There is no way to jettison modernity unless you revolt against it in violent terms, and that's precisely epistemologically and methodologically is prohibited in my project. Because one of the conditions for critique is that its constituent elements, that which makes critique, must be foreign and different, qualitatively different from that which it is critiquing. And since modernity is a revolutionary project that rests on violence and bloodshedding, then just as a simple matter of reasoning, then you have to conclude immediately that you cannot exercise violence in the project through which of course, now we get into the definition of what violence means, because some people might say even the birth of the child is a violent act. Babies come out from the womb of their mothers with blood and screaming, not laughing and having fun. But if we take violence in mostly in a political, with a political definition, then we must be very careful not to engage the paradigmatic props of modernity, and therefore I would not be on the side of jettisoning at all. But it is working through modernity as much as from outside of its paradigmatic system, its central domains. And what I try to do here for the educators, for the teachers, and those who are raising the new generation, is that perhaps some humility, and humility begins with the basic common sense that we teach, like we teach our children, well, you didn't say thank you, say thank you. Share your toy with others. These are values that we teach all of our children. Maybe we should begin teaching them humility. Because as I've just said in a class last week, as a historian, I don't know more arrogant bunch of species on the face of this earth than modern people. Absolutely. I cannot detect in history more arrogant groups than the moderns. So for example, this would be integral to education. And so if I were to be Mill trying to create a new system of education, I would make humility as an essential quality to teach our humility and modesty. Not to mention the other items that I have, which can be translated into educational terms. So this is my conception if I were to go into... why not Comte? Comte was... Comte was a fabulous thinker. Mad or not mad, many people like him. I hate the early Comte, but I like the later one. But he was not an Orientalist. My point in the book was
just a criticism.
I would say that what I wanted to achieve in the book is to bring in an Orientalist who first. Guinot died in 1956 or 60 something. In other words, Said knew, should have known about him, and should have known about him in clear ways. His name doesn't figure in Orientalism. Because if Said were to have read Guinot, he would he would probably think three times before writing his Orientalism, because it would have wrought havoc with his plan. My point is that Orientalism, and this is where I go to, I think, Sanjay's question, why Said and Orientalism? Because my idea is that Orientalism has been a one-way bridge from the West to the East. It was the bridge through which colonization happened and oppression and everything else happened, negative stereotyping, demeaning, humiliating exercises of power. But we have not thought of that this same bridge can be the most fertile ground to make it either one way in reverse or two ways even a little better. Two ways we cannot do it now. We should make it one way in reverse. In other words, through Orientalism, the West can begin the modernity now, can look through the prism of Orientalism in order to see what have we really missed. How arrogant were we in looking at other cultures and not trying to learn from them? Because there is always something to learn from. Because cultures are not just about past history of technology and physical reality and material. Cultures are full living beings. They have ways of thinking about the world. They have a concept of ethics that is so rich, so magnificent, so important. Why do we invoke Aristotle today? We don't have a problem with that. But if we invoke the Muslim moralists and thinkers, everybody has several horns that grow suddenly out of the head.
Thanks to some of whom we know Aristotle.
Exactly. And we know it developed Aristotle too. So the idea here is to use Guinot's concept of Orientalism in order to show that Orientalism can actually be a teacher. The very departments that are racist and bigoted today can be converted into a place where we send our specialized students to learn how other cultures did it better than us. And I'm not saying, again, I'm not talking about how agriculture can be better. We have perfected that art and we poisoned ourselves with our agriculture. We now learn to think about how others lived in the world, what was their internal logic, what was their cosmological view. I think there's much to learn from this that we are dismissing as past history that is always inferior to us. That's where I don't like the early Conti. Early Conti was a disaster in this respect, like Condorcet. I'm sorry I can't answer your first question, because I wished you told me that the paragraph was by Mill, because I wasn't trying. If you had told me that it's by Mill, I would have immediately contextualized it. By the time you finished with it, I lost track of what you were reading. So I'm sorry I can't answer that one.
It was on purpose.
Sorry?
To wrong foot you, it was on purpose.
Okay.
Question about Heidegger.
About Heidegger. Well, listen, I cannot take account of every thinker who said something about the project I'm doing. I know Heidegger's technology essay very well. It was used for restating Orientalism. I know about his project generally. How do I do something in light of a certain group that said something about the subject is not always possible. I'm interested in a particular take. Taha Abdul Rahman is one of my targets. I want to follow in within a particular way of thinking about it that is not necessarily Eurocentric. And even if these names that you have mentioned are resistant to Eurocentrism and are critical of modernity, I would like to begin at this stage of my career, as I have done earlier, to begin to introduce to the table of discussion voices that lay outside of the Western tradition. I think we have had enough of listening to Eurocentric people talking about their own world and telling us what we... I think it is important to sit and listen to people who are doing good work somewhere else. Abd al-Rahman Taha is one of them. If you read him productively, meaning if you try to... If you don't dismiss him because you disagree on one or two items he says, but really read him for the holistic project he has produced, I think it is an extremely important voice to listen to. Jaberi, for example, is for some people is important, but I don't see how he will be productive at all. I think his project is not productive at all. That's my preference. After all, I have my own intellectual agenda. So I find Taha Abdulrahman more useful, and I think that's where I would like to. I think I answered the second half of your about Orientalism, why Orientalism, but I didn't. Why Sa'id, you said, right? Is that your question? Why Sa'id?
Same question. Sa'id's Orientalism.
Because I wanted to take basically the best standing paradigm. I don't want to create, of course, a straw man's argument. What is really, so far, the only critique deployed against any academic field that is devastating is really Sa'id's Orientalism. We don't have real critique from not outside, even Sa'id is not, but as kind of from the outside a little bit, in which field that really would challenge the legitimacy of the field? We have none. So Orientalism, and the other thing is that I happen to be, in fact, it happened to be very expedient and nice for me, because I am an Orientalist. I have been writing for 40 years about Islam, right? Which I will get to your question about Islam. There is nothing more. All the divine signs came together in one place for me. Say, okay, I am an Orientalist. I have been studying Islam. I am an anti-Orientalist at the same time. But at the same, and I know Sa'id's work. It is the only field, my field. And listen, all you have said, Sa'id, is actually has almost missed the point and not sorely insufficient. So it was like a good auspicious set of circumstances to address the best there is, in order to see that it is actually being scapegoated and the others are equally culpable. In terms of Islam, I in fact in this book, maybe some people will have this argument about the impossible state that I single out Islam. But of course it is about the Islamic State, so I cannot escape that. But in this book, if you notice, I discuss Islam because this is the civilization I know best. I'm not a sinologist or an Indianist. So I study Islam, this is what I do. But if you notice that I always refer, almost always, join with Islam, other, because when it came to comes to the general parameters that I have read about and know enough about to generalize, I would say not only Islam, but also China and India. China and India always almost come together with Islam. But the details, I don't know well enough and don't feel confident enough to write about them in those traditions, so I keep it. But the argument, as an arch argument about power and ethics and knowledge, takes Islam as a case study. This is why I called it a case study, not the ultimate. There might be a Chinese case study or an Indian one.
That would be different as well.
That it will be different in details, but not in terms of a different. It cannot be. I wager with everything I've got that in terms of power and knowledge, however different they are, they will never share the grounds that Europe has created in order to create this wedding between knowledge and power. That's the point.
We started a bit late, so we'll be going till 7:10 to enable everyone to ask questions. Can we take more questions from the floor? Okay, so we'll ask these two people, the mustachioed person first, and then the purple-shirted person second. Oh, or you can arm wrestle to decide who gets the
first. Thank you. I'm Asif Akhtar. I'm a PhD student at NYU. My question is about sovereignty from Professor Haddock. So if we consider sovereignty as one of many techniques of the human, then what do you think happens in modernity that allows this one technique to become, in a sense, sovereign over other techniques? Or is it something that sovereignty does in order to conjure modernity around itself? So that's just a point or a paradox that I would like to hear your thoughts on. Thank you.
Hello. My question, as a swore materialist, is going to lead back to his one that I think God maybe lost in the middle about new materialisms, because, well, and I want to know if I understood you right, because, well, the anthropologist Viveiros de Castro, in a critique, in a, I believe, similar critique of post-colonialism and of, I think, Said specifically, said that once anthropology stopped conceiving its work as a pure imposition of West's own image on the object in such a way that the access to the object was always barred by that power knowledge structure, then anthropology could become a discipline in which decolonization could happen because, according to him, anthropology has been always penetrated, even against its own, even if unconsciously, by the concepts and the ways of living and the practices of its objects. And so I wanted to know maybe if that's why you're coming in through Orientalism, because you think it can be rehabilitated as a decolonizing discipline in that sense, or if it's a different thing. And if it is in this gesture of not conceiving everything in terms of epistemology and of how discourse predetermines everything and moving into a direction in which the object is actually active and discourse doesn't determine everything and matter is active and powerful and penetrating, then doesn't that make you a new materialist in that sense? Yeah, that was my question. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll go right into it. Orientalism has shaped Muslim discourse and self-representation. So Orientalism has had an impact on how Muslims talk and describe their experience of the past and of the present. So it's no longer just a case study out there for us to reflect on critically, to understand the logic of others. In a way, we have embraced that logic. And you know, as someone who's worked in Islamic studies, how many Muslims, even with subversive or projects of resistance, have embraced the very logic of Orientalism, and it's hard to escape from it. So any thoughts on that? And the other part of the question is related. And it's a simpler one. Does your project has any space or a planned turn back to rethinking how we study Islam in the modern world, how we produce knowledge about Islam? So
that's a big one.
thank you.
I will of course will not go into the second question. It's massive. But the first. The first question, well, it's precisely the purpose of this book, to take the rug from underneath, to pull the rug from underneath the entirety of the field of not only Orientalism, but all other fields, but specifically Orientalism and Islamic studies. The idea here is, you said some even subversive scholars, I think you are using subversive here in a way very different from the way I mean it in the book. They think themselves critical, that's what you mean. They critique or criticize, let's say, some Orientalists, but they are actually committing. The purpose, this is my accusation of Said, is that Said actually didn't go far enough, didn't really achieve what we should have achieved 40 years ago, precisely because he accepted the very premises he was criticizing. So in that sense, my argument is in the whole book is to say that that we should start from the beginning. So in my argument also is that the Islamic history has not been written yet. But I even have a larger proposition, a challenge that I keep saying, that in fact European history has not been written. Because Islamic history was written by Europeans, and European history was written by Europeans. So Islamic history is written by Europeans who cannot think of knowledge without power, and they wrote their own history. And that's also a biased project. Until Muslims and Chinese and Indians and others begin to write European history, then we can say that there is European history. So far, there is no European history. The other questions about sovereignty as a technique, I'm a little surprised to hear the characterization of sovereignty as a technique, especially in light of what I said about technologies of the cell. Sovereignty is not a technique. Sovereignty, in fact, is this is what I'm trying to accomplish in this book, is to bring people to think of sovereignty not as a political phenomenon. This is only the tip of the iceberg. Sovereignty is a mode of being. To go even to the Heideggerian ontological categories. So it is. I'm not casting it as a technique. Or it is in fact it underlies the entirety of the modern project. So in that sense, it is a premier ontology. Orientalism, again, we come back to the same issue. Why Orientalism? You are asking.
Specific point of view that I thought might add to that discussion, which is, are you thinking about rehabilitating that discipline as not a simple projection of our own epistemological?
Oh, yes, yes, so this ties into
something that can be penetrated by these
exactly. This is the idea of reading with, I teach.